I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversation in art, culture, and ideas. And today I'm sitting with Kwaki Assel. He is an academic, an educationist, a longtime human rights advocate, author of almost 40 books, and we're talking today about his newest book, The Malaysian Dilemma, My Memoir and Manifesto. Thank you so much, Kassel, for being here. So now I want to begin, before we get into the stuff of the book, really, okay. with an issue about motivation and why people write. You talk about coming back and kind of making a commitment to this country after spending some time in Britain, and saying that because you had a British wife, or have a British wife, that you could have stayed there and led an easy life. And it's kind of curious that you came back, partly because much of the 1% of Malaysia takes their either ill-gotten gains or otherwise, and, you know, they buy a house in London. They love London. You came back here. So I want to begin with that idea that you came back, you spent 40 years here. Has anything changed?
Anything changed? I suppose through the 90s, when I was in the movement to create an opposition front, that has changed with the 14th general election. I think that's the biggest change, because I was in the civil rights movement, and we were moving towards a two front system, we call it. Well, the two front system has proven to be something that's creating what I call the Malaysian dilemma. Now, one of the biggest component of this Malaysian dilemma, the political dilemma, is what do we do about these two political solutions that seem to be a version of each other, you know?
And so was it? I mean, was coming back making a commitment? Because when you spend a lot of time on planet Earth as a human being, and we are large spans as such, only a few people are gifted with an opportunity to experience radical change, right? Revolutionary change, radical change, significant change. Have you seen that in this 40 years? I mean, has your commitment to social change, to political change, been rewarded?
The biggest disappointment, I think, is the fact that after 40 years, or after how many years since the new economic policy, which was supposed to end in 1990, today we haven't seen the end of the new economic policy yet. To me, that's the biggest disappointment, because there are very few countries in the world today where we have such a policy of affirmative action based on race, you know. And so, to me, that is one of the biggest disappointments, and that part of that Malaysian dilemma of the economic equation, you know, to me, that's the biggest disappointment. But as far as staying the course, you know, I'm not disappointed, because I've all along since my student life, I've been a political animal, and not just political animal, not in the UMNO sense or the DAP sense, but political animal in a more progressive sense, you know. So I've seen wretchedness in Africa, Latin America, in everywhere, and I've seen the good life in the UK and the West, you know. And I really can't complain about my life since I came back to this country, except for the brief 445 days when I was a guest of the most ungracious Prime Minister,
Dr. Mahathir,
in Operation Lala. Yeah. So apart from that, I have no disappointment.
Right. So this is interesting when you talk about being a political animal, the need to participate, to express yourself. And there's a good number of Malaysians, I think, who fall into that category. They're huge numbers who are apathetic or who have decided, I guess, to kind of sit this out. Sit out, and I think we come back to this idea that you said your own disappointment was that the NDP hasn't ended. But your own analysis suggests that this is, in fact, the core of the modern Malaysian state. The use of the NDP in that architecture, mm-hmm. the use of race and religion, in order to keep the 1% in control and enriched. Why did you think it was possible to move that? It seems to be the unmovable in Malaysian politics.
Well, I thought that with time, those contradictions would come to a head, and I thought that in 1998, when the Reform RC movement started, that was the beginning of the end of that contradiction, you know, and that forces within the Malay community would come up and write itself, you know, and that by the time, and then when you look at the general election of the 14th general election, the manifestos that were coming out of Barisan Nasional and Pakatan Harapan, you know, it was quite a hopeful thing, you know, where both coalitions were asking for the recognition of the Unified Exemption Certificate. And Malay intellectuals were coming up to say, you know, we don't need the NEP, we don't need these crutches. You know, these are just enriching the cronies and the people who the elite in Namanol. And so there was some science coming up. And as a matter of time, because the contradictions will work itself into a head, and the masses in the Malay community would you know.
It's very interesting because, I mean, you're trained as a sociologist. You taught at the university I went to. There's a bit of a gap between our presence there. Not too much, about 7 years. But I do think that, you know, the sociology provide you a sense, or maybe a false hope. You know, there was modernization theory. We thought that, you know, that societies progress in a linear fashion, that we would dump feudalism and the culture that went with it, and so on and so forth, right? You know all this stuff. But then we've been proven wrong. Religion didn't fall away and become insignificant with modernity, urbanization, and industrialization. In fact, we see the reiteration of identity politics in each generation. Does that fact give you pause? As somebody working on the forefront of social and political change.
Yep. Although I was in the sociology department, my emphasis was always on political economy. So in fact, when I was in Singapore and I had to teach this modernization theory with another German professor, you know, it was much much against the grain, you know. And one of my main issues with that professor and that body of language of knowledge, and so I think that I wouldn't be so disappointed, because as things move on, you know, today we're seeing the gradual downfall of the richest country on the earth on earth at the moment, you know. Mm-hmm. Things are moving. We're seeing countries like Sri Lanka going through problems. And other countries in the world are going through lots of problems as well. So I wouldn't be so pessimistic about the political changes that will come about.
Okay, I want to ask you this. But we know societies change. I mean, we know economies change. But the question of the individual, yourself, human agency in affecting those changes. Because there's a whole body of political economy suggests that yes, maybe there is a role for the human being and in a collective sense, but there's something else at work, right? And you talk about contradiction. So this is my point. You write a memoir. It's a deeply personal way. It's a very modern mode of description, right? It's the self-possession, the individual looking at the world and thinking they can change it. I'm trying to challenge you on this because I think memoirs are fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you've led a very colorful life. And that's why I say, so you still, because I see in you this optimism. You pointed to all the positive changes that happened in this country, right? And so what keeps you going? I mean, what is it that you tap into for your optimism?
Because I can see that there are many things that I had fought for, I've written about, that are still unworked through. That's why this book is called The Malaysian Dilemma. There are all these different dilemmas in this country that we can overcome. And we know that the 15th general election is coming, we're seeing new forces coming up. Right, new forces that maybe that people are very hopeful about. But to me, again, you know, I'm not very hopeful because we have a new young party, we have a new group of independents, etc. But people are not. I think there's something about the political culture in this country. People are not asking for the policies that they stand for. You know, what are these young people standing for? what is this group of independent candidates? Isn't it a responsibility on their part to tell us what they stand for? Something basic like that, you know. I think it's very important in what this country. So we're really standing for something very basic.
Yeah, and I wonder about that, because in the 40 years, do you think the conversations or the problem has changed? Or has it remained the same? And, you know, whether Malaysia has graduated to higher order problems, because we know all human societies have problems. Often today's solutions are tomorrow's problems, but never mind. At least is the promise of movement. And that is something that, you know, that I think about a lot of times. I'm thinking that, and maybe I'm mischaracterizing the country, but it seems that we haven't changed. In 40 years and 35 or 25 years that I've been here, mm-hmm. that the problems remain largely the same. We're bedeviled by them.
Yeah, except that we compare our society to the 50s, the 70s, and now. I can see changes. I can see people in the Malay community standing up to say this is all a lot of bunkum, you know. We shouldn't be putting up with all this. And these are hopeful signs. You know?
Okay. And I guess your emphasis on the Malay community is because of the majority community.
The target of the populism in this country is the Malay community.
Right. So in some sense, they're the linchpin of change, if we're going to imagine change. Right. Okay. We're going to take a short break. And we'll be back with more on Let's Talk. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Putin. With me, Hua Kia Sung. He is an educator, an academic, a human rights advocate, a former ISA detainee, and author of many books, 40 books in all, many of them chronicling particular periods in his life. And I must say, Sung, I actually read in this handsome book that you have, the first book that you list is a book that I read. It was my first encounter with you, Class and Communalism in Malaysia. Yep. You were under a pseudonym at that point, and I remember it being reviewed in Race and Class, N. Sivanandan's journal, a very important journal, I think, in people interested in the questions of race in the 70s and the 80s. Okay, so you've the book itself is actually your journey, made
That's
easy
right.
in chronological, rather than thematic, right. in chronological order. I want to ask you why you chose to do that and what were the more difficult parts of the book to write?
The more difficult part, which is also the most interesting part for me, was that journey from when I was born till the time that I left for Britain. In 1969, you know, when after the trauma of May 13, and although it was difficult in the sense that I hadn't journaled as detailed a manner that I did after I went to Britain, from whence I made a point to chronicle my life, and this chronology is made easy whenever I'm in the middle of something, when I can sense that there is a book coming out of my experience, an episode, whether it was when I was in the DAP, when I was under Operation Lalang, when I was occupying the Vice Chancellor's office in Manchester University. So those episodes were chronicled quite well. But the period from when I was a kid till the time when I left for Britain in 1969, that had to be more researched. And although it was difficult, it was much more interesting, where I found out many things about my, you know, for example, about my grandfather, my cousin who was a revolutionary martyr in China who died at a very young age. And nobody would know that he was under the care of my father in Batu Pahat during those pre-war pre-war days, you know, and so he is effectively a millennial.
So this is your prehistory. These are the, as it were, the conditions that allowed you to emerge in the world. But were these years from your birth to when before you left for Britain formative in the sense that did they give you the worldview that you've come to be associated with? The worldview that drives your academic work, the worldview that drives your social activism?
No, I think the formative years from the time up to my teenage years, when I left for Britain, they were formative in my moral character. The moral character that my father and I suppose he was a Teochew. And I think the Teochew culture is quite different from the other dialects in the Chinese society. And a very strict father and a very loving mother and a very, very, very loving and very big. We all lived together, four families of the Khoas living in Batu Pahat. That was very formative. And so a lot of music, literature, that was formative. But what formed the political animal that I am today, actually, I don't think was formed during my childhood or my teenage years. It was formed when I went to Britain.
Right. Do you think, and that's very interesting, because the question is, what is at the base of your political commitments, right? And we see in Malaysia all kinds of strains, people coming out of their religious commitments, whether in Islam or Christianity, to become members of progressive movements, and so on and so forth, right? Very few, I think, people begin with a political worldview. I mean, they're not grounded in that. I mean, some people maybe. But so take us through the structure of the book. How should a reader who picks up this book, and, you know, this book is available here at the Gerard Budaya Bookstore, which I should have mentioned at the start of the show. We're here at the Gerard Budaya Bookstore in Petaling Jaya. How would you have people read it? Do you want them to read it from cover to cover in chronological order?
I would think so. Unless they have special interest. For example, there are some people at the moment, there's this spat between Lee Lam Tai and Lim Kit Siang, and the people who are the kind of DAP members and all. They might can jump straight into the time when I was in the DAP. They could do that. Or people who are interested in what life was like at Kamunting detention camp. That is very detailedly written in my chapter on, and so forth. But I think to know, like you pointed out very, very well, Sharad, about what formed me, you know the person and the political animal. I would think reading my early years is also, you know, quite important in that sense.
And, you know, okay, let's say, so for someone like me whose life overlaps yours, I can go back to particular moments, right? I can go through the 80s or the 90s, and I say, well, this is your view. And I was there too, so I have my view, and that would be a nice contrast. Mm. But for younger people, people especially, as we know, I mean, this is not to blame the younger generation, but every generation has problems with amnesia. We don't remember the past, and we don't really feel for the past. Right. So how would you have younger people who really don't know the 70s, 70s and the 80s, extremely remote times? Many people and young activists are now actually born in the 90s or the noughties, right? They're really from a very different period. How would you have them read that early period of your life and your influences?
No, I know that young people today find difficulty in finding the time to read a book. But I would think that I've written this book in quite a... I've shortened down a lot. Originally, it was about 400 over pages. And as a kind of rambling memoir, you know, it's written for your personal kind of satisfaction, or sometimes for your family's satisfaction. But when I found the theme, what I find is a very worthwhile theme of the Malaysian dilemma, many things have to be stripped down. You know, for example, my overland trip from Britain to here and my overland trip from here back through America to Britain, they were two separate chapters. And they were like Hitchhiker's Guide to the overland trip. Yeah. And so those had to be cut down drastically. Wow. Because...
I must say, I'll stop you, but I would hope that you have held on to that draft and one day that's published. Because, and I remember this about your book on the DAP as well, which I reviewed for a local magazine many, many decades ago, was that it was a very slim volume. And I remember you had actually written much more, and then you had perhaps on advice of your lawyers or whatever, decided to cut it down. And I hope those drafts are available, because there is something wonderful about the ramblingness. Because in some ways we encounter life that way.
Yeah.
Life doesn't approach many of us as a series of thematic considerations, you know, and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
Having said that, so younger people, and you talk about books, because we come from a generation before the internet, where pleasure, perhaps, if you went to university, was in reading books and browsing. Browsing was about walking down a shelf of books, wasn't it? It wasn't about scrolling on a screen. So if you can name some books that were instrumental in your formation, what would those books be?
When I was in university, you know, we at that time, there were those French Marxists, you know, Louis Althusser, those people. There was a very exciting part where there was huge debates, you know, about. And then during the 70s, when when China was going through its kind of a theoretical and political kind of
upheaval, the Cultural Revolution.
There was a lot of there was a lot of writing and debate in not just in China but in France and in Britain, etc. Those were quite formative years, and those books at that time were very important. And they were important when we were university. Books like T.S. Kuhn on the structure of scientific revolutions. Those were very good, and I'm still discovering these books. My most exciting read during the pandemic was John Bellamy Foster's The Return of Nature. I think that's an incredible. I recommend the books to my friends.
Okay, I'm going to pick that up because
that's an amazing book.
Because I'm getting into environmental issues as well. James Lovelock's Gaia and such. Okay, as we kind of wind down this interview and we come to the kind of the manifesto part of it. And the manifesto is very heartfelt. I read to, and because it's aspirational, it's about, the question, of course, is that many cynics might read this and say, well, this has been the pipe dream of the left since the inception of the idea of a Malay nation, even, you know, predating the war, right? And the Malay left and the Chinese left, everybody dreamt of a nation that was non-racial, that would focus on other things. What is the manifesto for you, and why did you put a manifesto? Why did you bookend a manifesto in this memoir?
Because it's the expected thing, and it's a rational thing for me. Because these are issues that I've been grappling with ever since I came back to this country, And although people say that these are issues that are age-old, they're pipe dream, etc., you look around the world today, how many countries are there where we have policies based on race? How many countries are there where we have political parties based on race? You know, why should we have to accept this? You know, it's not leftists that accept this kind of fact. Many people in South Africa won't accept it, you know. People won't accept that you cannot go into a university that is only allowed for Bumiputras, that kind of stuff. In this country, we think that it's normal. It'll always be this situation forever. I don't think so. It's a matter of time, you know.
Matter of time. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you. I mean, this is obviously a conversation that can go on for many hours, but we've run out of time. I've been speaking to Kwak Kye Song. He is the author of this book, The Malaysian Dilemma, My Memoir and Manifesto, available in all good bookstores, including this one, Agra Budaya in Petaling Jaya. That's all for me, Sharad Putin. This has been Let's Talk, only on Astro Awani.